And so let's get started here. The clicker. There. So first of all, this session is really about compute-intensive workloads in Windows Azure. So those things that run for a long time. And traditionally, they have been high-performance computing type of applications where you require a lot of computers to run to break down a really, really large problem and work them in a clustered configuration. So what you will do is that you'll hopefully, by the end of the session, learn how to build a service and also learn how to use some of the new tools that I'm producing for you. For example, you would be able to even move a Linux application very quickly onto Windows by simply doing all your development on Linux even. And being able to deploy, using Visual Studio, to deploy a cluster into Azure. So that's, you know, custom and all ready to go. And finally, building a service. That's actually quite interesting. So I actually built a cloud service, not the cloud computing service, but actual weather cloud service. So I'm going to show you how that actually works using the Azure Scheduler to offload a lot of these really long-running jobs. So here's actually the demo that we're going to show you later. But basically what it will do is that it will run the weather simulation on anywhere in the world, up to 3 days. And what I did is taking some really old Fortran code, glued them together with about, I don't know, 15 to 20 different programs to post-processing, pre-processing, downloading the data from the National Weather Service for initial conditions, do the prediction, run the compute-intensive workload, and then reproject them onto Bing Maps so that everybody can play with it and share the knowledge as well as the actual compute. So you can actually log on to the website and run that yourself. So that was never possible before. And for example, you know, probably 15 people in the world that actually would ever be able to run a weather simulation, given one, that you don't have the compute resources. For two, is that where do you get started, right? Where do you even get started? Because there's so many tools and knowledge that's involved. So cloud helps you to capture not only the compute hardware, but also the knowledge that's required to do very interesting things for the masses. So don't worry, you're going to be fine probably this afternoon at the Universal Studio. But you should probably get an umbrella. And also get some new ideas for teaching some old compute-intensive applications some new tricks. So being able to share and capture the knowledge, and perhaps, you know, there's business value and startup ideas for you to simply taking a application that you've built and perhaps offer it as a service and, you know, maybe even make some money off it. So, okay, so what is the problem? Like, as I stated, a lot of these compute-intensive programs are what I consider as time, space, complexity problems. It's just a buzzword, really. And time here, it means it requires a lot of CPU to run the program. And space requires a lot of memory. So a lot of these models are actually built in really large matrices, and they stay in memory. It requires a lot of memory. So it doesn't even matter how fast your CPU is. If your model doesn't fit in the memory, it's not going to work. So that's why you need a distributed system to build these type of simulations. And in order to do that, traditionally in the industry, people have done two things. One is that you need the resource manager to manage the clusters that you're actually doing the computation. So that's a resource management tool. But the second piece that's really important, which is not on the slide, is the software compilers and all the ecosystems and libraries and things that you need to build out that model. So for example, linear algebra libraries, and perhaps specific modeling tools that you need. So there's, you know, two things that you're going to need. Compute power, three things, right? Hardware. In addition to that, you need software to manage the hardware resources you have. And you, of course, need the applications that run your that you need to run. So how does it work? HPC, or high-performance computing, has always been described as massively parallel. So some of the largest machines in the world are somewhere in the orders of a million cores now due to the reason that people added a lot of GPUs in them. So I actually have four of those GPUs in my office they have 448 cores each. So I have four of those. Of course, my office runs really hot. But on the other hand, you can do some interesting things. But of course, the problem with being able to parallelize your application is that not every problem can be actually divided and, you know, parallelized, right? So, I mean, that's a classic problem that cannot be, you know, easily solved. But we parallelize the pieces that we can, and we look for problems that are, you know, identifiable as embarrassingly parallel, which can be divided into smaller identifiable units of work and do that. And a lot of these programs are in here. One is digital media rendering. So Pixar rents and buys and owns these giant rendering farms. And what they do is they render each frame in 8 hours or 10 hours. Some of these new movie frames, which I actually show you an example of, can be 8,000 by 8,000 pixels, or sometimes even larger. So think about the resolution that you're looking at. You multiply that by 30 frames or 24 frames per second, and you multiply it by a two-hour movie, and plus all the edits that they have to do and they throw away. So this is a tremendous amount of computing power that goes into these digital media production. And the second piece is financial and risk calculation. And most of us have 401k, so this is what they do with our 401k, which is run these simulations. Essentially, computers are competing against each other to figure out the most optimal portfolio risk configuration is. And also insurance companies try to run simulations on earthquakes and figure out the probability over a year's time. And for each of the properties that they own in a portfolio, and then computing the derivatives of those, and so on and so forth. So as you can see, it becomes a very complex system. That's why the computers have really taken over a lot of these complex calculations to make sure that the mistakes that was just made by J.P. Morgan doesn't get repeated. But that's a human problem, right? It's not necessarily a computer problem. This, but you definitely need the computing power to be able to compete. Engineering modeling, and this is where this is all originated. Computer engineering modeling, we have a lot of examples of that today. So being able to offload your long-running simulations to the cloud. So I actually have a really good example, which we have, most of you probably have seen a Dyson vacuum cleaner. So do you guys actually know how it works? Probably not, right? So I actually have a simulation that I'm gonna run in a cloud, and it's gonna tell us exactly how a Dyson vacuum works internally in terms of the actual airflow and why it actually does work. It's called the cyclone model. And also computational life science. That's actually one of the biggest computing consumers out there. So there is a couple of machines that are being built. I think it's Blue Water or one of those machines that's being built and CSA. That will have, I think it was 20 petabytes or some crazy amount of storage, and also, I just don't remember by now, millions of cores to be able to run their molecular dynamics simulation to you know, discover better configurations of proteins. And also earth science, earthquakes. We actually have a really cool video that I want to show you today on earthquake simulations and also the weather visualization. So, and finally, data analysis. This is actually a new area that people are going into called big data, but that's a topic that I attempted to discuss on Tuesday. So people trying to figure out the most important aspect of it is people trying to figure out the and analyze the collective intelligence of everyone that logs onto their website or, you know, all the essentially looking at data and figure out the human behaviors of things using MapReduce. But we're not going to go into that so much. And so now, cool videos. Or you guys can tell me it's not that cool, and I won't show it next time. So here is one video that I really enjoyed watching. So this is the precipitation in Northwest. And one of the reasons that some of us don't really enjoy living in Seattle. So look at how much rain that we get. And also we have weather simulations that actually does the simulation and tells you why Seattle actually rains. It's not really Seattle. It's the fact that Seattle is inside a valley and everything around it is a big mountain. They just rain and rain and rain. Mount Rainier is called Rainier for a reason and just rains like 10 inches a day just continuously. It's actually quite dreadful to look at the simulation of Rainier. So I stopped doing that, but I used to run that for fun stuff. And also this is the actual earthquake that happened in Japan on, I think it was March 11th, is that right? Okay, my memory is still working. You can actually do all of these yourself now, given that there are a lot of these seismic code and as well as the weather simulation code actually on the web, free. And you can build services that can calculate earthquake, and you can tweak it for your own models. But I'm certainly not saying that everybody's going to become an earthquake expert, but for the things that you want to do, the things that you're passionate about, you can, now that you can, with the availability of the cloud. So that's one of them. And I want to show you another really cool video about HPC. So Ryan in the back is smiling. He's from the HPC team. So this is actually 30,000 computers. And you can see the each of the green means the CPU is actually doing some work. You can see that it's just really working. 30,000 machines working together. 30,000 cores, I apologize. It's 30,000 cores running at the same time to solve one problem. So this is what people do nowadays to conquer really large computer simulations. Okay, so that's that was fun. And finally, this is actually a simulation that I ran myself, which I always like to show. I built a while back. So this is using a 3D visualization tool that actually did the visualization piece in parallel. What you did is you actually loaded data in parallel and pre-processed it. So that's really quite interesting of a 3D visualization. And that actually brings me to a problem with the cloud, which is, you know, moving data from the cloud to your on-premise to have these type of rich visualization can become a little difficult. So that's actually a problem that I want to, you know, just kind of stack here. And we can have a discussion about that later and how, you know, what you can do to actually solve it. Okay, so let me flip back to the slides real quick here. Okay, so video's done. And, of course, this is my HPC demo using Microsoft Paint. Now I'm switching back here. So here are two images that I rendered previously using a ray tracer. Getting back to the Pixar story. So this is one that's actually in HD. But if you look, if you zoom in, that's not really HD anymore when you zoom in, right? So let's look at a 20,000 pixel by 20,000 pixel image. Which requires about 8 hours to render per frame on a, you know, 8-core machine. Let's look. So now that's your data in HD, 20,000 by 20,000. I think they are going to have that out next year for a new Samsung monitor. I'm kidding. You can probably stack it on a wall, but look at the clarity. So this is the reason why you can never have too much computing power. And that's why, as the megahertz war becomes, you know, megahertz race kind of stops at about 2 gigahertz, you need more and more machines to work on dividing the problem into smaller pieces and work on it. So ray tracing is actually a very dividable problem into per pixel trace. Anyway, so let me get back to my slides. Okay, so let me kind of explain the programming model a little bit again. So, embarrassingly parallel. So, these are the things that I call each unit of work is really well defined. So, if you want to render lots of frames, that's, you know, one. If you want to solve a different configuration of a problem, let's just say you had a vacuum cleaner that you had, you know, moved apart a little bit and changed a little bit, and you have 100,000 different configurations. You want to find the best one. So, this is embarrassingly parallel, which each problem doesn't communicate with another problem. So and you can run them on one processor each. And you can run lots and lots of it. You can run a million of them, the performance will still be the same as if you were running one of them. Does that make sense? Just one unit of work. And the second one is tightly coupled, what I call MPI, which has been in the industry for a long time. So this actually requires very specialized hardware, meaning MPI is having all these nodes talking to each other like mad, millions and millions of times per second. So for example, if I were to try to solve a really large matrix problem, when I rotate a row, I need to talk to the guy next to me and say, hey, you know, here's some information, update yourself, right? So those are the kind of problems that are traditionally used in engineering. Matrix solvers is one, typically one of them. And there's a problem with that model. It's very brittle. As soon as you have to have talk, a lot of machines chatting to each other, just like human beings, right? As a company at Microsoft, we have lots of people. And if you have each group talking to each other all the time, you probably never get anything done if you go to meetings all day, right? It's the same as the problem here. So to solve that hardware, people have invented hardware that are microsecond latency. So InfiniBand, those are the kind of hardware you need for solving that problem. And the second interesting thing about it is that most of these applications don't scale beyond 64, 128 cores or so. They don't, because when you get chatty, they just don't. But when you actually see a diagram of the program running, you'll see that they're talking to each other, lots of them are talking to each other as they are moving forward. So that's the trait of a tightly coupled or MPI. And it's industry standard, runs on Linux. Most of them run on Linux. There we go. And that kind of brings me to one thing that I want to talk about, which is how do you take a Linux application and do almost nothing and get it to run on Windows? So I'm going to show you that today. And I built a set of tools that allows you to do that without much performance sacrifice. OK, so here's IO-intensive applications. That's the MapReduce application we discussed. And that's really not the topic of today, but you might want to kind of start looking at that if you're interested in big data type of problems. And I would encourage you guys to focus on scenarios rather than what tools there are out there. Kind of try to see if you can solve your problems. And tools always come later. So there you go. So they use the disks a lot. For example, Yahoo's cluster has 12 disks. They don't really care about how fast the CPUs are, but they care more about that. So here's the HPC server, what it does. And it's the simplest possible explanation I could offer, which is you have a lot of machines that you want to manage, and you manage it through a cluster manager. And a cluster manager keeps track of how many nodes you are, which one is turned on, which is turned off, which one is running what program currently, how long it's going to run. So I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but that's basically what it is. It's a management tool that you should only just, use it when you need to and as a user. And you should focus on solving your problem. And we did that for you, essentially. So we do the management of batch jobs, priorities, and all those things for you. And in the last few years, we actually built a Windows server which can control Windows 7, Windows HPC server as a cluster, so you can control a bunch of Windows 7 machines, and also Windows Azure nodes up there. But we're not really going to focus on that today. The reason is because it's a server product. We're going to focus everything on Azure, meaning that the cluster management tool will be in Azure, and also the Windows Azure nodes that are doing the computation will be sitting in Azure. OK, so here's the three different configurations. You have a hybrid, you have on-premise, everything runs on-premise, meaning that you go buy a bunch of hardware, you manage the cluster using a head node. And second is a hybrid. You buy a cluster and with maybe one head node that does the management, and the rest of the nodes could probably sit in Azure. Who actually runs that configuration here? OK, I see one person. That's actually not a really good product if you have a department which you want to submit jobs to a Windows NT server. Windows server, and then all the jobs get automatically moved onto the cloud transparently. And finally, the cloud configuration, which allows you to simply deploy a cluster in the cloud and send jobs to it and turn it off whenever you want. So it could be your personal cluster, it could be someone your sysadmin spun up that your user can use as a service. So something like that, and it's fun. So these are the kind of things you can possibly do well, which is host everything on there. There's no on-premise nodes at all. Right? You don't have to worry about that. It comes actually with a little portal, so you can see which job is doing what. You know, it's like a status monitor. You can add a web application front end on top of it if you want. And also, there's different business models that can come with it. I'm not going to go into too much. And finally, the most important part is that you have the runtime. The runtime enables you to do different different applications that build on top of these DLLs. For example, MPI. You need MPI to run your application. Parametric sweep, which is the embarrassingly parallel application where you run something a million times. So we all built that for you. You can just simply use that instead of building your own, right? And also, building a scheduler. Here's the things you need. You need an Azure subscription. I have a free one, but you may have to buy your own, or you get the MSDN trial, and your application, of course, and just about any application. Azure is just Windows; it will run just about anything. And a constructor, a CS package, and which Visual Studio will do that for you, and customize and deploy it. So let's probably run an example. So here's how it works: you have all your applications running in the compute worker role. They're Azure services. And front, you have a head node that controls everything, right? And then finally, you have a web interface where you can submit jobs to, look at the status of what's going on. So that's kind of something really under the hood. Like, nobody really needs to look at it unless you are really building the application. So this is really for developers. For those of you who are not developers, I have entertainment, but that shows you how to build interesting things, but this is mostly for developers to want to build their services or something like that. So here's what it looks like. Visual Studio, and you can run this by simply click on play and select how many nodes you want in the cloud and just say deploy. And it will deploy a cluster automatically for you in Azure. And only thing you have to do is to make sure that your management certificate is in there. But that's it. So let's actually do a demo. So I actually do have a PowerShell script if you like to just type. You just press enter, enter your subscription, press enter, just enter all your information. Pretty straightforward. So that's kind of fun. But regardless of whether you're actually a developer or not, this is actually fun to watch. Because how else would you get six or eight computers instantly in the cloud, right? So where is my demo? Here is my demo. Okay, there. So the question is this a specific version of Visual Studio? It's 2010, and I already made a mistake here. So Visual Studio, when you run anything cloud, you need to run as an admin. So I forget once in a while. So 2010 would work, 2011 would actually work. Just make sure you install all the right tools. In fact, there's something you need to install the SP4 Azure Scheduler, and you need to install the Azure SDK. And that's pretty much it, really. So let's actually open this up. So I'm going to say open project, go to demo one. So as you can see, you can't really double-click on it. I mean, I'm tempted to always double-click on it. So the first thing is that you'll see that there's app configuration project in here. The nice thing about it is that it already does everything for you. How many nodes do you need? It has all the configuration done for you. There's a why did I click on that for? Sorry, I didn't mean to click on that. I didn't mean to click on that, right? So there's all these configurations that you it already set up for you. Now I'm actually looking for the let's see, references. That's what I was going to show you. So in the app configuration, what it does, it actually uses SQL, uses let's talk about how it works first. So when you want to deploy something into Azure, the first thing you're going to do is you need management certificate. The next thing you're talking to the Azure service and saying, hey, I want a head node, and then I want a cluster, right, a bunch of compute nodes. And then finally, I need to create a little database which manages all the jobs that are coming in and out. And also I need a web role, which is showing the portal, right? So those are the kind of things you actually need. So I'm going to go ahead and run this real quick. And here are some sample applications, of course, you can run, right? Let me see it. So am I building it? OK, it is building it. So I'm going to say it is building. So it'll take a few seconds. So if everything goes right, what you will see is the little dialog box, which would allow you to enter the number of nodes you want and your subscription and all that information. And once you're done, you just send. OK, so hold on one second. Yeah, there you go. So I have my subscription ID already entered in there. So you have to go to your Azure portal to create a subscription. You buy one, basically. And then I had a management certificate. If you don't have one, you just hit create. It will just create one for you. And then your service name, I called it HPC deployment sample in the Western region. And the username and password is really for logging into the cluster because they're actually compute nodes, right? So if I just say I want one head node and four compute nodes, and if I can hide that a little bit, it actually says config. So I'm going to try to attempt to click on that. So once it finishes doing the configuration, you hit deploy, and it will go out to the machines and say, OK, well, I need a database. I need two medium nodes. One is for the head node, which manages everything. One is the web role, which shows you the portal. And then I also need four compute nodes that are actually doing the computation, right? So that's what a cluster typically looks like. And it's going to take its sweet time. And I guess I could click on publish now. As you can see, it's adding certificate service, and it's doing the compute now. It will do the add the certificate. Then it will try to create a database. You have a question, sir?
Simple question. What does head mean? What?
Head node is the node that manages everything. He's the manager, so he's the head that manages everything. So he will, basically keep track of what the database is doing, keep track of where the jobs are going. So he's the manager. Think of it. So the rest of them are worker bees, right? So that's kind of how it works. And it's going to go on for a while. So probably it will take you, I would say, 20 minutes or so. So we don't really have that much time to wait around. So we're going to go to demo number two. And we'll go back to the slides, and we'll come back and check on it later. But I do know it works. OK. So this is, the first scenario where you're actually deploying a cluster. So pretty straightforward. You select the number of nodes you want, and you include your applications in the package, and you deploy it. So here's another scenario. This is actually a tool that a friend of mine and I built a while back. And what it does is, the Fluid Dynamics code, which has almost a million lines of code that's included in the compute engine. This is actually quite valuable because it competes with, commercial software that are very, very expensive, thousands of dollars per core. And it can do, a lot of what it can do. It's free, for one. And so we just, ported it and onto Windows and added a nice little UI on it. And you can run that by offloading some of your workload to Azure. So the original thought about cloud when I first started doing cloud computing is that cloud computing should be simple and transparent to everyone. You should not have to know, I'm computing in the cloud. The whole point is that you can't touch the cloud, and you can't really, you know, hold in your hands. So I has always thought about something such that your application should transparently run on just about any hardware you own. So what I call this is, you know, transparently run on client, meaning shared memory on your local machine, run on a cluster, which is your local cluster in your basement, and finally in the cloud. So just simply selecting an item or resource you want to use and run that. Okay, so let me switch back to the demo machine and show you the actual demo. There you go. So let's see. So as you can see from the pre-demo, it tells me the database exists, which is the database that configures everything. So I'm just going to say, OK, continue to deploy while we show you another demo. So here's demo number two. For one is that here's the model, the Cyclone model, which is kind of fun, actually. You know, your vacuum cleaner is not as simple as it looks. But think about the mechanics. It took them, you know, many, many years to design this. But if you actually can figure out the right model and run it on, you know, a supercomputer over time, it can do a lot better than a human being. So for example, let me actually give you an example. So before we do this, I want to get this running before I tell the story here. So go to the preference, go to physics, and go to, you know, parallel. And I actually added a few more here. You can run it on GPU, you can run it on shared memory, you can run it on cluster, you can run it on a cloud, you can run it on a cloud burst, and you can run it on a cloud cluster. And let me explain what that actually means here. I think this is probably the only program in the on the planet that has that many options, right? So shared memory is really your local machine, right? And GPU, CUDA, which is your GPU, has 445 cores, but it does not actually run much faster than a really fast CPU. The reason is because the parallelizable part, there aren't that many of it. And the library I use is, you know, you can use the CUSP, C-U-S-P, you know, linear algebra solver on the NVIDIA GPU. And finally, a cluster, which is, you know, a local Windows cluster, right? And then the cloud, which is talking to one of the cloud instances on the web without using the using our scheduler, just simply talking to one extra large instance, just talking to one without doing anything. That's your instance. It doesn't know how to manage it, just one. And then finally, a cloud burst, which is talking to the server, which actually sends the job to the cloud. And finally, the scheduler on the cloud. This is where you actually talk to the cluster that's deployed on the cloud entirely. So we're going to choose that. And we're going to, of course, enter a few information here. You know, you need Azure, you know, the service you deployed, which is done exactly the same way you saw. And I want to use 7 cores for this particular job. So I'm just going to hit run here. So when you actually hit run, what's interesting is that I can, let's see, I have to find the right one here. I can actually go to the web portal. So just by going to the web portal, this is the web portal that is sitting in the cloud that comes with the cluster that you deploy. So if I refresh, hopefully it will say there's a job running or not. I just hit all jobs. Let's just see if it shows anything. Do we see it? Oh, great. So this is the job that's actually running right now. And that's job ID number 25. And you can see, you know, you can create a new job right there from XML or from submission page. And you can, you know, type like date. It will actually run it for you. But it will schedule some resources to do whatever you want, really. I mean, you can upload some files or run like right there if you know how to type the command correctly. Essentially, what in the background, what it's doing, it's saying, you know, running OpenFOAM on some input file, right? I mean, that's all it's doing. So that's what it does. So here's something interesting. So let me kind of explain how it works first. First of all, when you're on the client locally, when you run a program, you open a file, you have to actually open a file, right? So that file doesn't get just opened in the cloud. So you need to send that file into the cloud. So you need to copy that into the cloud. So that's why we have something called a blob storage, right? So that's persistent. So even if that machine dies, hey, who cares? My file is there. So the next thing that happens is that the compute node that has been assigned that job goes off to the blob storage and grabs the file, computes it. When it's done, it sends it right back down to the blob storage, and the client is notified and gets it. So pretty straightforward. But on the other hand, it does require that extra layer of work. So let's actually look at the client. Oh, it's actually done. See? So let me actually explain how this vacuum works a little bit. So the way it works is that it sucks the air in from here. And there's a little funnel there, right? So what happens is the funnel becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. So the velocity, as you can see from the color, gets slower and slower and slower and slower. And then it gets compressed. Essentially, your air gets compressed as you, you know, go into the funnel. And then, finally, when it reaches the other end, it shoots right up. So you can see that it goes in here, and again goes, you know, shoots right out, right? So then the velocity increases like crazy. There you go. So there's the new velocity, which means it just shoots up. So that's why it's got all the suction there, because it's, you know, you're really compressing here. So back to the business scenario, which is, you know, what if you are able to design a better product that is better than that? And if you had computer systems that would be able to use less electricity, less noise, and be able to use better materials. So there's a business to be made here. So one of the example I want to point out is that we actually had, this is something that someone told me, Ford was actually doing a design optimization. So they ran, I think it was 6,000 or 8,000 different samples of a part. So it took about 60 engineers a long, long time, 3 months to optimize for maybe 0.1%. But after the computer run, for like 3 days, they were able to optimize for 0.5%. I don't know the exact numbers, so please don't quote me on it. But it was a, you know, 5-10-fold improvement just by running these simulations, you know, correctly, of course, right? Okay, so that is my demo for the, you know, using a rich client that without much modification and offload your work onto the cloud. So one thing I do want to show you is, it's actually deploying heavily. See, I was right. So one of the things here is that it's, you know, finished deploying. So actually, let's look at the portal. So this is back to the first deployment. Let's take a look to see what's going on there. So let's look at the cloud services. You guys would have to help me a little bit on this because, you know, I'm heavily drugged on Advil here. Let's see. This is the one. Ah, now I can actually see it. So you can see that it's deploying, and I think you click on instances. So right now they're in unknown state, and soon they'll say, you know, provisioning, you know, ready. So they'll go through their provisioning state, right? So some of you have already run that, right? So you know exactly how that works. So we're still creating a cluster here. On the other hand, we have shown you the first program that does the offload without a lot of programming and without much intrusiveness to the user. It's, you know, the way they've always worked, and this is how it works. Okay, back to the slides here. So, and this is the, you know, really complex-looking diagram, but there's really three steps in there. The first thing is that you zip up your file. If you want to add additional services to a cluster that has already been deployed, so this is how you install another program on it. So step number one, take all your files, put them in a folder, zip it up. Step number two, run HPC pack upload. Okay, it's just a simple command. You upload it to the blob storage. And step number three, cluster run HPC sync, which means every compute node will know how to grab the new program you installed onto each of the nodes. Does that make sense? So this is how you install an additional program. I'm not going to go through it. There's a lot of documentation that talks about it. But when you initially deploy, you can include that in your Visual Studio deployment. But if you want to add more stuff to run without tearing your HPC cluster down or update your program, this is the way you do it. OK. Question, sir.
Simple question. Does this assume that every node has identical copy of the same application?
That's correct. We actually copy. When you see HPC sync, it's a clusrun command. What clusrun does is that it runs on every single node.
So, yeah.
Right, so this is for copying the files over. This is for installing programs, so it will be the same operation, which means you're synchronizing every program to have, let's just say, Python or MATLAB. So for running jobs, that's different. And then you use the job scheduler to assign jobs. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so I have scenario number two. I want to show you a really cool demo, which nobody has ever done before, I don't think. I'm going to run a, on a Linux machine and take that program, run it on Windows within 2 minutes. Or maybe three, I don't know. Let's see. Okay, so here's a Linux box that I logged into. Go ahead, question. Oh, switch. Ah, thank you. Okay, so I am going to do a this is better, right? So this is actually a Linux machine running on our IaaS offering. So if I do ls, I can see there's a lot of stuff in there. So the program, you know, what's actually happening here is that I have a set of tools that I assemble together, which helps you to build a Windows binary on Linux. So let me show you how it works. So I'm going to run a, go to Windows. I love command line. Okay, so I'm kind of just want to walk through this a little bit. You know, you don't have to understand every step. So the first thing is that you can see that the first line actually tells you, you know, a bunch of libraries, you know, their directories. You won't have to worry about it. And then it says CD Windows, tar XVVF. It's just, you know, unpackage some program. And the third thing is I actually go into Windows and actually go build that program. But instead here, I am actually picking Windows as a target and say, hey, I want to build this as Windows. So this is what the first line is actually doing. It's loading a module, which includes all the Windows tools. And when you do a compile, instead of having a Linux binary, it outputs a Linux binary. So I'm actually going to go run this script real quick. I'm going to say execute.shell. As you can see, actually doing compile, it will compile everything and make it into executable. And what I'm going to do is we're going to copy this onto a Windows Azure node and you know, show you that actually works. Oh, we can't hear the thunder. So while it's actually compiling, what I do is oh, there it is. It's still compiling. OK. So while it's compiling, what I want to do, oh, it finished compiling. So what it did is actually created a, it created a file called, there you go. It's called, created a file called pop.zip, right? So if you look at the current time, date, it's actually just produced, so 29, right? So the next thing I want to do is I want to log into. So does anyone know how I can get out of this mode? Oh, Control 4, that's better. So what I want to do is I actually want to go to Azure. This deployment is still going, huh? So I'm going to just go ahead and close that, and we'll look at it later. What I want to do is I want to go to Azure Portal and go to, you know, any one of these machines. So here's a actual compute node, right? So here's the sample deploy. Look, you know, these nodes are actually ready, right? So let me actually go to, another one, which is the OF cloud cluster, which I want to log into one of these machines. Say connect. So as you can see, these Azure nodes are no different from an ordinary computer, which you can terminal service into. Okay, so I actually have a little tool called WinSCP. So what's happening here is I'm logged into the Linux machine, and I'm going to copy over the software here. So if I click on POP, and you can see this file was, you know, modified 729, which is, you know, something that we probably want, you know, to copy over. And we're just going to copy it over. As you can see, it's actually quite fast when you copy it over. And then what we're going to do is we're going to go to user documents. So we're going to go here. I go to documents, and I'm going to type command. Just, you know, unzip that file and run it. Extract all. Extract. Ah, there you go. So I'm actually done. So I'm going to go to the transfer directory and type in the command. So you can see that there's a pop.exe. So what this program does is actually the parallel ocean program. So it simulates the ocean flow. What I'm going to do is I'm actually going to say MPI exec pop maybe minus and 4. So this is the tightly coupled program which requires MPI for communication. Let's see, pop.exe. So as you can see, it runs. And what I did is I'm on the Linux machine, and I produced a Windows binary that I can just simply copy over to one of those Windows machines and just run it. So this is a tremendously useful tool for technical compute users, because a lot of these programs are actually done on Linux. You know, I actually have about almost 100,000 users that would be able to use, you know, benefit from this particular solution. Anyway, so that was the Parallel Ocean program that I just simply ran, built on Linux, using my tools, and just move over and run it on Windows. Right? So that addresses an important problem for a lot of these technical compute workload, which is, you know, suddenly have access to a lot more sources, a lot of source code on Linux, right? Okay, so here are some of the other tools that I make available to people or have been working on, and also they're known to work, that you can, you know, use in your program. A lot of them are libraries, you know, solver libraries, which would benefit a lot of people for doing these type of programs. And finally, I want to, you know, we just heard the thunder. We're going to actually go look at a service that I built for simulating the weather forecast up to 3 days by simply taking one of these, you know, ugly-looking little Fortran program you just saw, and you know, really teaching an old HPC program some new tricks. Okay, so let's run the demo here. Okay, so I really, really like the new portal. Anyone have been using it so far? Quite a few. Great. So this is a portal that I built that's based on the Windows Azure HPC scheduler. I can never say it the proper way. Is it the HPC Azure scheduler or is it the Azure the Azure HPC scheduler. So this service is built entirely on that. I mean, if you look at it, it's actually relatively simple to build. I have a front end, which is a web page, and then I have a lot of the stuff, you know, kind of sitting in the background. So let's look at gallery. So the gallery page shows you all the simulations that I've ran, and these are animated GIFs, which I produced from the actual data file that NetCDF, they're called NetCDF files that I have. And as you can see, you can kind of just look at it at a glance, because it's actually really hard to visualize data sets that are, you know, really, really large. I mean, this is 5 gigabytes of data. You're not really going to browse through that 100 of them at a time. So I produced an animated GIF every time a weather simulation is done. So let's actually click on them. So if you're on a higher resolution, I have built tiles that sits on top of Bing Map. So these tiles, it's actually like little tiny squares. As you zoom in and zoom out, these tiles are different sizes. But the nice thing is that you can actually see quite a lot more details in these images. And how are these images produced? They're done by using a program called Ankar Graphics Language, which is also built in the 1970s. But what it does, the interface, is that it produces an image from a data file. But you know, what are you going to do with that? So there's additional processing steps that converts into Bing Map. So this is a lot more shareable than some guy's Unix directory using some JPEG viewer or NCL. So this is really about sharing the data and also reproducible scientific results. So there's a lot of applications for that. So this is actually a forecast that's going from up to 3 days from this morning. That's right. So it looks like there's going to be a little bit of a storm going on, as we heard. So it's a very accurate model. It uses a finite element model. And what it's actually doing, it's actually dividing the atmosphere into 27 different layers and running a finite element model over it. It's actually quite parallelizable. That's why it's using the MPI program, because you can simulate one column at a time as you divide up the space. So let's see. So let me actually show you a couple of interesting things on this. One is that for this particular service, so the weather service, I actually have a heat map running. If it runs. Nope, that's a different one. Oh, it's disabled. That's a different one. Hold on. Is that the cloud service? That's a disabled. Okay, so that's not the one. Let me actually take a look at the cloud service. Okay. So I think I know what happened. But so the idea is that if this were working, you would actually see the CPUs going all crazy. So I don't actually mind if you guys actually start submitting a little bit of jobs to the cluster. So if I go to home and go to new forecast, it allows you to use the Bing interface. So right now it thinks I'm actually in San Diego. That seems a little wrong, but it's probably a cable that tunnels out there. So let's actually run a simulation here. So anybody know exactly where we are? North, south?
South.
Okay.
West.
West here?
More west.
Okay, here. All right, thank you guys so much. So we'll just say Orlando Conf Center, and we're going to hit save. And let's actually look at the processing queue. So I actually have one job running that's right now. But if you hit number 50, it will actually say scheduled or queued. As you can see, it does take a little while. And the reason, I actually had a discussion yesterday, is that I actually had a little timer that picks up a job every 25 seconds or so. But in the grand scheme of things, this simulation actually runs for 8 hours. So if it delayed for a few seconds, it's probably not that bad. But the problem is that if you do want to run really short jobs, that want to submit 100,000 jobs within 5 minutes, so that might become a bit of a problem. So there's an optimization issue here. But there's something we can do about that, which is you upgrade the head node and its database. So if you update the database and make it a stronger, bigger database, that will actually help you to scale much more. So let's actually see if this simulation got submitted here. Let's see, maybe it's already in the processing queue here. Ah, see, there it is. So there's our simulation. And in 8 hours, you will be able to see what it's actually doing. But for now, it's going to be very compute intensive. So the next thing I want to show you is the timeline. So sometimes I go do demos for people, and I can track back and to see, okay, well, when was the day where I actually ran a lot of these? Let's take a look. This is interesting here. Ah, there's a day that I ran quite a few of these. So you can actually go look at it by timeline. So this is really combining the power of Bing and the just some old executable that nobody probably knows how to run, and being able to produce a service that just about anybody would be able to run. And I also have a map which shows you where exactly all the runs are, all the runs that I've ever done. And the interesting thing about Azure is that, to be very honest with you, that I don't trust other people running my cluster because I have a cluster. I have an 8-node Cray cluster. I know it goes down all the time. I just don't tell people about it because I have users too. But the fact that I actually have to manage it, somebody calls me up and says, I need a demo tomorrow, and their cluster is down, that annoys the crap out of me. It really does. Here it is. Here comes your ring. But thank you. but Azure actually has been running, and I have data on this machine that shows it never goes down. Of all the machines that all the time I ran this service, it didn't go down. And so that gave me a lot of confidence in our product. And of course, the data center running guys tells me, well, what do you expect? SLA is 99.95. But it's true. But when you want to run a serious business, I wouldn't trust me. I would probably trust a group of professionals running it. OK, I'm sorry. OK, go ahead. Question. You know, that's a really good question. How would you compare the service that I'm running right now? So the service that I'm running right now is compute intensive, meaning that you throw something at a machine and the CPU spins for 8 hours, 8 cores. I mean, that's a lot of CPUs running for that forecast. That's a real, real forecast. But MapReduce, you're really talking about having data sitting on your cluster. The key difference is that they have a transparent file system, meaning that to the user, you're looking at a file system that is just one file system instead of multiple on multiple machines. I don't have to go to machine number 7 to grab this file versus machine number 8 to grab another file. So MapReduce is really for processing data rather than compute intensive. So this is really more about compute intensive workload. So let me actually go back. So this is, I want to finish my talk here. As it's raining, I'm sorry that everybody has to go to Universal Studio today. Should have looked at my forecast, the organizers, I mean. So here's a little roadmap. We are actually released just the latest version, and I encourage you guys to try it out. The simplest thing you could do is just, the first demo I did, log on, download a sample, just go deploy a cluster and play with it. That's the simplest way. And the next thing is that I really want you guys to think really hard about what can you do. And I'm not talking about specifically running it on Azure. I'm just thinking about the cloud, the fact that there is a public cloud now. What kind of programs can you do, or people that can have innovation that goes beyond just simply institutional scientific research? So, for example, if I wanted to do research on sheeps that are sitting on my farm, not my farm, I actually have a colleague that has very genetically isolated sheeps that he runs and he tags and he runs these genetic algorithms on. And he actually found some very interesting things about these group of sheeps. And they are genuine, apparently. So apparently now, people are, you know, the researchers are looking at his sheeps to trace back, you know, hundreds of years for all the sheeps that people have. So there's a lot of things you can do with, you know, the availability of the public cloud. So that's something I want to kind of, you know, put it out there. And things will always get better, I think. You know, things are always going to get better. You know, I'm also going to admit that, you know, it is relatively difficult to use a lot of these tools as a developer today. But we also had modems in 1995. Anybody remember a 2400-volt modem? Oh, there you go. You used one. I actually had one. My dad had one. I actually used it. It was interesting. It was a lot faster than a 300-volt modem. That's what my dad said. But the interesting thing is the network will get faster, and the cloud hardware will get better. But the abstraction of the cloud is very powerful. The fact that you can, you know, without having to manage your own hardware and be able to suddenly grab a large chunk of hardware and do what you need to do to solve an important problem that you have is very powerful. Of course, you have to have your problem first that you want to solve. And also, software as a service. And I think this is actually an area where people can make money off of. Take your idea and make a business out of it. And I'm very passionate about you know, technical compute workload. And also, I had 9 tips on there, and I even forgot what they were, so I'm going to reduce that to 4. So hide the cloud from your users. Really, that's very important. Abstraction, the cloud should not be seen by the end user. If the cloud is seen by the end user, you are doing something wrong. Minimize data transfer from on-premise to the cloud. Because, you know, that's important. Use caching. So be able to cache things and do things more intelligently, that's very important. Also, CPU intensive jobs are really very well suited, especially for this type of jobs. It's perfect for the cloud model. So take advantage of it because it's actually cheap. You actually, you know, get your money's worth by running compute intensive workload. And I think that will be about, you know, easily 30 to 40% of all the cloud compute workload is, you know, compute intensive workload. And they are simple. You're simply using the hardware to do some compute. You know, really be creative. Focus on what you can do rather than a lot of people say, okay, well, the cloud cannot do this. Like I said, the 2400-volt modem problem will actually get solved very soon. Well, it was solved, but now the networking problem today, which people complain about 1 megabyte per second transfer rate, you know, I'm astonished sometimes. That will get solved, and cloud computing will become much more ubiquitous. You know, these are some of the things that you can, you know, try out. I have my blog up there, but I apologize, I haven't really updated. But to be honest, a lot of things don't change. All the code that's up there still works. But I will make sure that I update this. You know, probably go into more details about how the Azure Weather Service works. I mean, it's actually, you know, quite interesting. I will have to turn off my microphone for saying this, but we're back. Download and try out the Azure Burst Sample, which is really simple. And thank you very much for staying. If you have any questions, please do come up and talk to me. I guess those are the mandatory tracks that I have to flip through. But anything more you guys would like to see? We kind of did finish early, 10 minutes early. Anything? Maybe we should take a look at you know, whether the cloud actually deployed or not. I mean, we can, you know, take a look real quick. It looks like it all deployed. So they're all ready. All the nodes are actually ready. Any questions? I have some time for questions here. Yes, sir.
How do you go about estimating how much compute resource do you need for your particular task, given that, you know, there could be some, limitations, basically, right? Whether you use some storage that may be slow, so machines would talk less. So how big is the individual node should be? How would you go about what do I need to solve my problem in most efficient way?
Okay. So, you know, so this gentleman has a very generic question, which is how much resources would you be able to estimate to solve a problem? So I think using heuristics is probably one of the most common thing people do to, you know, estimate how, you know, your job will be, you know, how long things will take. One of the things that I found to be very effective and useful is that people keep track of jobs they've previously ran. And this is a very good way of estimating and minimizing risks for running your program. And of course, you know, there's no easy way of doing that unless you have run it a couple of times. So I would say the easiest way is to actually run it a few times and then do the estimate. And like I said, you know, cloud doesn't necessarily have the fast interconnect right now for you to run, let's just say, MPI type of programs. So they're best to just be very practical and say, for example, my weather service, the MPI program can take advantage of multiple nodes, but I only run it on one node. The reason is because I know two nodes doesn't really scale that much for me. So find the problems that you can solve today is important. And also, hardware will catch up much faster than you can, than you can estimate. Hopefully that answers your question.
For example, let's say my job is already running, right? Or maybe it ran, finished. Can I get like statistics back? Basically, was my maybe node underutilized? Did I put too much or too little? Kind of, and
good
then
question.
Based on this, go forward.
Good question. The question is, how do you know your job is running optimally and where it's having problems or not? So I think the two things to keep in mind. One is the diagnostics. Diagnostics are really important. So in your program, you can turn on some logging. I mean, this is what I used to write a lot of MPI programs, so I log a lot of information to see whether it's, you know, where it's supposed to be. In fact, if you look at the weather demo, I log like crazy. So I have huge amounts of logs. This is actually, so that's one thing. Oh, okay, sorry. So if you go to, let's just say, a processing queue, and you just go to, you know, any one of these guys, and you can see there's logs and crazy amount of logs, show logs. So that's one way of looking at it. And also we have diagnostics. Cloud Services actually has diagnostics. We'll show you what your CPUs are doing, a lot of things. And another thing that's really useful for me is that you actually want to log into the node and look at what's actually behaving. So that's very important. I mean, that's the easiest way for me to do it. You know, other than turning in logging, which is to log into a particular node and interact with the job a little bit. I mean, this is the only, you know, the kind of things that is kind of common to debugging, right? I mean, I agree with you. It's not necessarily all that trivial and easy, and it's always, you know, a lot of time it's very specific to the problem that you have. So I can't really, you know, tell you what exactly you will have to do, but, you know, look at my problem. I run into problems with these things all the time, but look, you know, there's logs of crazy logs everywhere. You know, I can download and look at, you know, what's going on with the application performance logs, you know. I think that's the answer that I have for you, which is it's part of the debugging process. It may sound really harsh, but that's why we're getting paid as developers. Any other questions? Okay, yes, sir. Right. So there's a couple of things that comes into mind. One is that what do you want to optimize? Do you want to optimize for saving money, or do you want to optimize, you know, for the maximum CPU utilization? And it also depends on whether your program is internally parallelizing using threads or not. Can it take advantage per instance of multiple cores? So it really kind of depends. And that question gets asked all the time. But let's just say, assume, you have 16 processes. Each uses one core. Let's just say eight. You have eight you know, threads, eight programs we want to run, eight jobs, let's just say. Would you allocate one extra large and use the eight cores there? Or would you allocate eight small instances and do it there? My personal opinion is that I would do one extra large machine just because, you know, one less machine is less problems to troubleshoot. And the other nice thing about it is that you can, you know, also debug a lot or relatively easily. But the disadvantage is that if you have just one big machine, if you have, let's just say, eight jobs that's followed by a job that takes only one cores, and you can't run anything until you, you know, run other jobs, then you're wasting a little bit of CPU time. Does that make sense? Okay, so, I mean, it really depends, but personally, for ease of debugging, I just use extra large instances, and if money is not an objective, but there are people that run millions of these things, you know, then, you know, they'll probably do things that are slightly different. That question does come up quite a bit, yes. Any other questions? Yes.
Repetitive. What about Azure in this regard? Will it make available at some point the GPUs some form or fashion?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And the question is, will GPU be available on Azure anytime soon? So I think, you know, that is something that Microsoft is looking at. Unfortunately, I'm not part of that process. But my thoughts are, I'm just, you know, sharing my personal opinion here. Yes, GPU definitely has its place. But also, you know, I'm going to say, you know, why would we want to run GPU versus why we wouldn't want to do it? So if we, you know, we want to do it is because customers want it and so on and so forth, right? I mean, it's a very compelling story to rent a $6,000 machine when you have each of these cards costing you $5,000 a piece. But the second thing is that those things are very expensive. GPUs are expensive, and they're easily breakable. So in order to put anything in the cloud center, you know, cloud computing data center, it has to be certified, for one. It has to be easily operational. You know, you can easily operate on it. And the third is that we have to have enough business needs for that. So it will take a little bit of time. But I think eventually it will show up. And I don't really have any time, but I can, you know, assure you it's not going to show up in at least 6 months that I know of. But I think, you know, this is something that people are looking at. And to be, you know, real honest, I don't think it's the majority of the cloud usage. You're not going to see that much cloud usage. And if you look at some of the other, you know, vendors that offer this, if their GPU gets old, you have a whole data center of GPUs that get old, and you can't use them. So I think let's see. You know, I know certain people have C2050s. Those things are not good anymore for me. So I can't use them. So you know, I think it'll be good as an industry that, you know, let's just say Microsoft puts out a small set of data center that has the newest GPU. And then 2 months later, another vendor puts out another, you know, set of really fancy new GPU. I think it's at a point where I think the industry need to kind of collaborate together to provide that as a service to be efficient and effective. This is just my opinion, but you know, of course, they all compete with each other too as well, right? So I think the best bet is to go buy one. I know, that's why. Yeah. And if you go rent it in the cloud, it will still be expensive. True. Any other questions, gentlemen? That's OpenFoam. And we're going to go back to the weather service. As well, so let's just take a look at whether it's relatively accurate here. You know, I think I may have actually ran this with you know a slightly different parameter on this particular simulation, but I think it would actually be raining, and then stop around you know at night, and let's just you know kind of just take a look at it and see whether it's accurate or not. So. Plus 9, what is it, frame or? Oh yeah, so plus 9 is like right around right now. So 22, yeah, it looks like it doesn't look too good here. I'm sorry, it's gonna rain for a little while and into the night, so. Well, thank you all very much. I think that's the end of the session. I know we've got 1 minute left. Oh, we're actually 1 minute over now. Thanks a lot, you know, thanks.